From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello, and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Nancy Marshall Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace, and Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent. Welcome, Nancy and Chris.
Hey, Kim.
Good to be with you, Kim.
Well, here are the issues. Witness testimony continues in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who has been charged in the death of George Floyd. Floyd, a 46-year-old black man, died in May 2020 after Chauvin placed his knee on Floyd's neck while he pleaded, "I can't breathe." His final moments were recorded on video and led to widespread protests against police brutality and racism, as well as incidents of unrest. U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to promote a $2 trillion infrastructure plan that includes addressing roads, bridges, drinking water, electricity, and transit systems. Biden's team says the new package proposes a massive investment on par with Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal or Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. But is everyone on Capitol Hill on board with the plan? Shipping was on the move again on Tuesday in Egypt's Suez Canal after tugs refloated a giant container ship which had been blocking the channel for almost a week, causing a huge buildup of vessels around the waterway. The Ever Given is 1,312 feet long and can carry up to 20,000 tons of containers. At least 10% of the world's shipping passes through the Suez Canal. Meanwhile, another backlog off the coast of California. The Marine Exchange of Southern California says 24 container ships with a combined maximum carrying capacity nearly 10 times that of the newly freed ship were anchored off the coast, waiting for space at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. We'll look at the economic ramifications of these incidents during an unprecedented demand for goods during a pandemic. And protests continue in Myanmar cities against the military takeover that reversed a decade of progress toward democracy that followed five decades of army rule. At least 521 protesters have been killed since the coup, according to Myanmar's Assistance Association for Political Prisoners. The U.S. State Department has ordered all non-essential personnel and their family members to leave Myanmar as the military's bloody crackdown against anti-coup demonstrations continues. Well, let's get started with the issues. Chris, I'll start with you. The world gets a front row seat to the trial of Derek Chauvin, as it is the first ever courtroom video live stream for the state of Minnesota, though jurors and minor witnesses are not on camera. What has stood out for you so far in this trial?
It's been a riveting, emotional trial so far. It's just been a few days in, and already we've had some incredible testimony from some of the witnesses in the case. We're seeing for the first time different video images of George Floyd, who died in police custody back on May of last year. And it's just riveting. And the cable news networks in this country, and I'm sure some outlets around the world, are carrying this trial live. So you get to see the things that we didn't hear about in the beginning that sparked this whole thing. And I think one of the takeaways from me is that right now we've heard from witnesses who watched this incident take place and how devastating emotionally it was for them to witness this former Minneapolis police officer putting his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds until his breath was exhausted.
Yes, and Nancy, I'll go to you with that same question. What has stood out for you so far in this trial?
Yeah, well, on the third day, we heard from Christopher Martin, and he's the 19-year-old clerk at the Cup Foods, the convenience store where Mr. Floyd was accused of trying to pass a fake $20 bill. And Martin was saying, you know, if I hadn't said anything and hadn't called the police, this never would have happened. And Martin said he had thought of even, you know, taking a $20 bill out of his own wallet and just replacing Mr. Floyd's bill with that. So it seems like there was a lot of guilt Of course, we've been covering this through an economic lens, and one thing that occurs to me is it seems like the verdict could really energize not just the Black Lives Matter movement, but also the movement in the U.S. toward more economic equality. Economic inequality has really been exacerbated by the pandemic. We still have 10 million fewer jobs now than we did at the start of the pandemic in the U.S. The Century Foundation is estimated about 40 million Americans received about $580 billion in unemployment just for 2020.
That's a really good point, Nancy. And Chris, I just want to bring up something to you. Ben Crump, who represents George Floyd's family, he made a powerful speech ahead of this trial. And one of the points he emphasized was the trial was going to be a referendum for equality and justice for all. What do you think he was referring to in this statement?
Well, he's referring to what has happened in the past where, you know, a lot of these incidents have happened and people have been denied justice. And I think they realize that this case isn't as easy as some might say if you watch the video and see what happened. But you have to remember that a lot of police officers in this country kill about 1,000 people every year. And out of that number, 121 officers are arrested and charged with murder or manslaughter, but only 44 of those are convicted, and usually they are on lesser charges. So I think Mr. Crump was saying that a strong determinative verdict against this former police officer is needed for the country to feel like, for the first time in generations, that justice actually is being served and for the people.
And you also brought out a really good point in this not being this first type of trial. So I'll put this out there to both of you. This trial will be about what happened to George Floyd 10 months ago. But this trial also falls into the category of others, such as the trial after Rodney King's beating, the trial after Emmett Till's murder. This case will be viewed as another chapter in America's racial history. Your thoughts on this?
You know, one thing that's interesting about this trial is that we've seen the police vantage point. We've seen the video from the cameras that they were wearing, and you can see that George Floyd really was not putting up a fight. He was scared. He was saying he was claustrophobic. That's why he didn't want to go into the police car. And I think that's something that's a little different from what we saw previously, especially, you know, incidents that happened 20, 30 years ago.
Chris?
This is the most closely watched and most significant police brutality trial probably in a generation. And I think you're going to really need to focus on the jurors in this because, you know, there are 12 jurors. If one, it has to be a unanimous decision. So if one is not going to feel like they can convict the former officer, then there could be a hung jury. And I think there's a lot of pent-up concern about that and anticipation, and hopefully this won't happen, but I think there is this kind of concern that it could happen.
Yes, that is a really good point because there are some who look at what happened to George Floyd as an anomaly, that perhaps Floyd's death was the rare exception instead of proof that the police are the bad guys. Or do you think all law enforcement need to be reformed because of the actions of this particular case?
I don't think so. I think that the prosecution has argued that police officers definitely have a difficult job and they often have to make split-second decisions, but they maintain that this case isn't about split seconds, that former Officer Chauvin had plenty of time to try to de-escalate the situation and certainly not have his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for that amount of time. At the same time, the prosecutor also said that Officer Chauvin crossed the line, and there is no training of officers that they are to utilize this kind of move where you place somebody's knee on the neck with an incredible amount of pressure that blocks their airways. So I think they're saying that all officers are not like this, and the majority of officers are good law enforcement people. But this was one rogue officer who did something incredibly wrong and should be punished for it.
Nancy, your take on this.
You know, Kim, a lot of surplus military equipment has been sold or donated to local police departments over the years. And I think the tide on that is starting to turn. Maybe they're realizing that they shouldn't have this kind of show of force. Also, they're wearing, or they're supposed to wear, body cameras that will show exactly what they're doing. I mean, this trial, the trial of Derek Chauvin has been so emotional. You know, you've got witnesses crying on the witness stand, a retiree who was weeping and saying he just felt so helpless because, of course, if you interfere with an officer, it's considered a crime. I mean, people were standing feet away from George Floyd, watching him die and feeling completely helpless.
Yes, and we could probably spend the whole show talking about this particular topic, but we'll move on to looking at President Biden's infrastructure plan. Nancy, Biden's team says the administration's approach is transforming the old ideas of infrastructure investment into a 21st century concept that includes developing the human capital of America's population. Do you agree with this?
It's a huge plan, but as you mentioned, it is just a plan. Congress has to approve this. But yeah, he wants to spend more than $2 trillion. He wants to modernize 20,000 miles of roads, build 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations, repair aging schools, repair lead pipes and service lines so people don't have to worry about lead in their water. Something that I've been reporting on is the money that Biden wants to devote to science. And the administration is really trying to showcase this and say that it would bring us back to the era of the 60s, this space race of the 60s when we were landing men on the moon routinely. So he wants to put $180 billion into science and focusing on artificial intelligence, biotechnology, super fast computers. You know, we'll see. The reception on Capitol Hill, especially among Republicans, has not been unanimously supportive.
Yes, and that brings up the next question. And Chris, I'll go to you on this. Biden's Build Back Better agenda is expected to incorporate and support his broader goal to achieve carbon-free power generation by 2035 and net zero emissions by 2050. Not only some Republicans, but some Democrats and even climate activists, maybe all for different reasons, fear that another failure to pass meaningful climate legislation amid concerns that a clean energy transition will cost jobs. What is your view so far on this?
Well, right now the administration says they will produce jobs. And I think out of this whole package, they're estimating a job creation of about 2.3 million jobs by 2024. But these type of projects are expensive, but you've got to get it going at some point. But I think for the Republicans, a lot of this is hard to swallow because going towards these energy efficiency and climate change initiatives is expensive, and they're wondering who's going to pay for it. And so in order to pay for something this large, you're going to have to raise taxes on the wealthy. You're going to have to raise taxes on corporations. And right now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of support for that, even though some people look at the benefits of climate change and having energy efficiencies that is going to make this country more powerful and more sustainable, but at what cost?
That's a good point that you raised, Chris, with Biden is proposing to raise the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. Nancy, what is your view on this? It seems that raising taxes on the rich seems to be always a proposal that really trickles down, affecting everyone.
Yeah, I mean, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said that's a non-starter, raising taxes, especially corporate taxes. He says this whole plan is a quote, a Trojan horse for a massive tax increase. And remember that one of the big accomplishments for the Republicans when President Trump was in office was rolling back corporate taxes in the 2017 tax law. So this would be rolling back one of what the GOP sees as a big accomplishment. But, you know, President Biden is also facing opposition from within his own party. The chairwoman of the Progressive Caucus wants a much more to be done on climate change. She doesn't think that the Biden plan goes nearly far enough in that. So there's a real balancing act here.
Absolutely. And we will continue to follow developments on the president's Build Back Better agenda. Well, time for a quick break. And when we come back, we'll examine the economic ramifications of the delayed ships in the Suez Canal and those off the coast of California. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Nancy Marshall Genzer, Senior Reporter for Marketplace, and Chris Simpkins, VOA Senior TV Correspondent. Well, panel, looking at the incident with the container ship in the Suez Canal, as well as the blockage off the coast of California, Nancy, I'll ask you this. These incidents have shown a light on a potential weakness in how raw materials, components, and finished goods are transported through choke points, with possibly severe implications for the global economy. What lessons are to be learned from this?
Wow. You know, I think one lesson is that we rely so much on the Suez Canal, and also that the idea lately in the shipbuilding industry has been to build humongous ships like the Ever Given, which is as long as the Empire State Building would be if it were laid on its side. And if you have so much reliance on one canal and one ship, you're putting all your eggs in one basket. So I think people are realizing maybe that's not so smart.
Yes, that's true. And also just looking at that incident that did happen in the Suez Canal, Chris, in a March 24th statement, Evergreen Marine Corporation, the owner of the Ever Given, the ship that was stuck in the Suez Canal, said gusty winds of about 56 kilometers per hour had caused the ship's course to deviate. So just looking at it, I guess, from an investigation standpoint, what would you say is needed to determine who is at fault? And do we know if an investigation is even underway?
I'm sure there is, because this incident caused a tremendous disruption in the flow of trade. Either they're going to have to dredge that canal to make it a little deeper for some of these humongous ships that are coming there. Also think about making the canal wider and other ways to make sure that we don't have this kind of incident again, because it's costing billions and billions of dollars and driving up cost of materials that, like lumber, that you would not believe, and not being able to get those supplies here has driven, and other shipping concerns have driven up lumber 175% since the pandemic. So I'm sure there's going to be a full-fledged investigation to get to the bottom of it and make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yes, and Nancy, do we know yet how these delays of container ships will affect consumers in the days ahead? For example, the ships waiting to dock in Los Angeles and Long Beach are carrying tens of thousands of boxes holding millions of dollars worth of washing machines, medical equipment, consumer electronics, and other goods that make up global ocean trade. Should consumers be concerned about this?
Well, not to panic anyone, but apparently among the hundreds of ships that were stuck behind the Ever Given, some were carrying the type of wood pulp that is used to make toilet paper. So there could be a temporary shortage of toilet paper, but people should not go out and panic buy. Also, apparently, coffee was stuck on some of those ships, other consumer items like furniture, also gasoline. So we could see a little spike in gas prices. That was all in the Suez Canal. But separately, we have had a backup of ships outside the port Long Beach in California. And the pandemic is really to blame for that. A couple of things. We are ordering a lot more online. So we are having a lot more ships come into Long Beach with carrying things made in China, but also some of the longshoremen, the dock workers, are getting sick with COVID. And so there's a shortage of dock workers. So it used to take maybe a few days to unload a ship at Long Beach. Now it's taking up to a week.
That's a very interesting and very good point. So we'll have to hope that maybe, like you and Chris have pointed out, that this doesn't happen again. But then there's so many components. There's the size of the ships, the weather, and we are in a pandemic. So it could very well continue to happen as long as we're in this pandemic. Well, let's look at the situation in Myanmar. Nancy, this week, catching guerrillas attacked a police outpost in northern Myanmar in an indication of the deepening involvement of ethnic minority armed forces in the country's popular movement seeking to unseat the junta that seized power in February. Well, the situation there seems just to be getting worse. From a humanitarian perspective, what could all this nonstop violence lead to?
Well, the military has been killing, apparently, children. A boy as young as 5 years old was shot, apparently. And Myanmar's special envoy to the United Nations this week was appealing to the international community and saying, look, history will judge us harshly if we don't do anything. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was asked about this at a briefing this week. He said, you know, the U.S. has been escalating economic sanctions on Myanmar. But he said the international community needs to do more, especially countries that have significant investments in Myanmar, companies that are helping to fuel the military with money or taxes or whatever they're paying the government. And he said maybe they should think about moving and producing things in other countries, just leaving Myanmar altogether.
That's a very good point. And Chris, more than a dozen of Myanmar's ethnic minorities have been seeking greater autonomy for decades, going through cycles of armed conflict and uneasy ceasefires. So we already have so many crises going on in the world right now. Where do you think this crisis stands, and where should it stand in terms of global issues?
Well, it should be right up there at the top, I think. We have a serious situation going on in this country, and it's affecting already vulnerable groups, these ethnic minorities who have suffered so greatly. And it's also causing instability in the Southeast Asian region as a whole. And I think some of Myanmar's neighbors are concerned that, you know, an escalation in violence. You've already had some estimates say 520 people have been killed since the violence began. It can destabilize the whole region, where you can have floods of refugees coming in to neighboring countries next to Myanmar. And so I think that people should keep it at the top of the list, and diplomats should be working overtime to try to address some of the tragedies that are going on in the country, because right now it does not appear to be easing. The scene appears to be growing worse.
Absolutely. And you and I, Chris, have talked previously about the passion of protesters and activists. And Myanmar's activists, they're encouraging now ethnic militias to join forces with them against the military. Is this another sign of just the passion that the activists have now?
Yeah, I think so. And these activists are taking more bold steps, like silent strikes with businesses and shops closing, and activists urging people to stay in their homes and shutting down, you know, entire towns and cities. So they feel that that kind of pressure and the people's power pressure can work to try to resolve this situation with the military. It's one that will take a majority of the people to rise up, as well as the international community to do what it can to help in the country. But it seems like right now you have some very organized activists and very passionate, angry, and determined activists who want to create change in their country.
Nancy, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, I mean, just going back to Myanmar's special envoy to the UN, he was calling on Russia and China to stop selling arms to the Myanmar's military. If their supply of weapons was curtailed, it would be a lot harder for them to shoot the people, frankly.
Well, and on that note, that's about all the time we have. And thanks to panelist Nancy Marshall-Genzer, senior reporter for Marketplace, and Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.